Before we get started with today's show, I wanted to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, The Low Post. It's the number one NBA podcast for a reason. Top executives, coaches, players, and the best analysts in the game. Be sure to check it out. You can download and subscribe to The Low Post as well as The Right Time wherever you get your podcast. The Right Time with Bomani Jones podcast is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. This is the time of week where we do an interview. Before we get to our guest, I just want to let you guys know, because people have been asking me about my emergency situation, I did, in fact, get some shea butter. It was not the shea butter that I had ordered, because that's still floating through the U.S. postal system. But shout out to Shalonda, loveleafskin.com. Right before we did this, I went downstairs. She overnighted me some shea butter, got a little beard butter in there with it. I'm going to check it out so I won't have to be ashy no more. Thank you. Now, speaking of our guest this week, I just want to mention something right fast. And I'm guessing that this thing is always there. I don't think he broke this out just for my own entertainment. But behind Joel Anderson, as we speak, is a big old canvas of him, I'm assuming, when he was the fastest 10-year-old in America. Like, what is that, 11 by 14?
This is when I was one of the fastest 11-year-olds in America. And my wife got it for me as a gift. And what else are we going to put up in the house? I mean, you know, there's nothing else that looks as good as that does right there. So we might as well put it up. People come right in the house and they can look right at it. They can see what this household is all about. Achievement.
You're not a little bit ashamed of this. Not even the least bit ashamed of this. Your wife has to laugh at this, right?
She got it for me. She the one that did
it. I know. But that don't mean she don't laugh at it.
Yeah, I mean, she does, but she knows I'm fast, too. So, you know, it kind of goes both ways.
You and this fastest. I mean, I have to say this. If I was the fastest 10-year-old in America, I guess I'd probably want people to know that, too.
I mean, why would I ever not claim that? You know what I'm saying?
No. The question is not why would you not claim it. The question is why do you insist upon continuing to claim it 22 years after this happened?
Hey, we've talked about this
Excuse me. 32 years.
Look, we've talked before about making people feel good about your own greatness. You know what I'm saying? Haven't we? We talked about this, right? And so this is a way to let people get comfortable with it. I don't talk about much else. You know, there's plenty of other things I could talk about. You know what I'm saying? But I decided to settle on this because it doesn't intimidate people as much. You know what I'm saying? It makes people comfortable. Everybody can join it.
Why don't you put a picture up of that car that you bought after you went and met with Chris Bosh, and then y'all went to the parking lot. When Chris Bosh was in high school, you went to the parking lot and Chris Bosh was riding clean, and you were realizing that you needed to go get a new car.
He broke. My face was broke. I was like, we walking in the same parking lot, talking to 17-year-old Chris Bosh with his other teammate. And he's talking to me like a grown man. You know what I'm saying? And then all of a sudden, he peels off, gets into like an Escalade, Navigator, you know, some one of them big bodies. You know what I'm saying? And I get into I was driving my mom's 1992 Toyota Corolla. And I was just like, oh, okay, it can't be like this anymore.
These kids ain't never gonna respect me.
Oh yeah, I was like, this looks sad. I'm supposed to be the adult here. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, man. Now I want to start with a story that you wrote for Slate that I actually think is a really big thing. And I've kind of gotten into this a little bit before, but it was about Liberty University. As much as everybody wants us to stick to sports, or at least they claim that, or at least they used to claim that, right? They want us to stick to sports. But nobody really says anything about Liberty jumping into our sports. And like, Liberty makes it impossible for us to stick to sports simply because it is an institution of higher learning. But I mean, it's also the face of a political movement, right? I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, definitely a face of the white evangelical movement in this country, started by the founder of the school, Jerry Falwell Sr., and, you know, picked up, and Jerry Falwell Jr., the president of the school, has inherited that movement. And this isn't even necessarily about white evangelicism. It's about like far right conservatism. And he's really aligned himself with President Trump. And that has a lot of fans on campus, but it also has a lot of detractors.
Yeah. And I think having detractors on campus is one thing. The other issue is you can't, it's very difficult to separate the politics of liberty. I mean, it's impossible from race. Like, if you start talking about something far right in the United States, it is generally considered to be antagonistic toward Black people. There's just kind of no way around that. And your story was talking about the Black athletes who are like, yeah, I'm out.
So I was talking with a professor of religious history who has written about liberty a lot. And he talks about the fact that it was founded basically out of this pool of white supremacy, which is to say, when Jerry Falwell Sr. started up this school in the late 60s, early 70s, this was a school that was explicitly founded like as schools were desegregating all around the country. And previous to that, Jerry Falwell Sr. had founded private schools that were whites only. So that's sort of the roots of the school. And it's not like they've separated themselves from that. One of the most amazing factoids that I discovered while researching the story and writing about it was that the school of government is named after Jesse Helms.
Oh.
You know, I was like, that's the name of the school of government. And I'm just surprised that that'd never come up before. I'd never heard that before, but it says to me a lot about what the ethos is on that campus and sort of what they think about, you know, hewing so hardcore to white supremacy. Because, I mean, you can't embrace Jesse Helms in that way and put him on the face of your school of government and say that, like, you're seriously trying to have a reckoning in this moment about, you know, racial inequality, police brutality, all these other things, and to have that dude be the face of your school of government.
That's the dude y'all chose to name y'all company after?
I mean, yeah, right. It's crazy.
Did he give them money, right? Because I don't think of Jesse Helms as being rich in the way to give anybody enough money to get your name on something. Like, that seems like a tribute to the man's work, not repaying the debt of the donation. Like, I could be wrong on that.
Yeah, if he's given some money, I missed it. I didn't see that. You know, when I was looking at the about section of the Jesse Helms School of Government, they didn't get too much into it. They just talked about his career as a politician, right? Without talking about the things that he advocated for as a politician.
Well, hold on. Here we go. I'm looking at this at liberty.edu, July 7th, 2008. And the headline is Senator Jesse Helms, friend of Liberty University, dies at 86.
Yeah.
Yo, here's the statement from Liberty's chief operating officer at the time. He was a gracious Southern gentleman. This was in marked contrast with the fact that he was known in Washington as Senator No, because he just resolutely stood for what he believed. Whatever he had a conviction about, it was non-negotiable.
I mean, they didn't talk about what he believed, right?
No.
The press release didn't get into that, right?
No, I'm scanning through that, and I have not seen anything saying what exactly it is that he believed. Well, hold on, here we go. When the moral majority first came into the public spotlight, Godwin said, it was viewed as a mere point of public interest, but as it gained momentum, the media began to paint it as an ominous force. Quote, the media turned very negative toward the moral majority, and Dr. Falwell first began to experience a firestorm of criticism. Senator Helms is very public and vocal in his support of Dr. Falwell and for conservative Christians being allowed to enjoy all the rights of citizenship that everybody else did. And I just need to know, what are they taking from y'all?
At what point were their rights at risk? I mean, somebody got to tell me. I don't know.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. Who has told them that they couldn't do nothing other than, like, be too mean to us? They can still be mean to us, but not too mean.
I mean, basically, that's it. They're just like, look, man, like, we're just going to change racism. We're going to put a little twist on it. You know what I'm saying? Like, we're not going to say these things out loud. It's not going to be explicit, but we can figure out ways to get around it. And, like, that was just too much. They got crazy. You know, people got crazy because, like, nah, man, I want to be able to call people whatever I want to in public and not patronize them and not let them into my schools and not let them into my families. You know what I'm saying? But I mean, maybe this is something that you and I can relate to because we're roughly the same age. Jesse Helms was one of those people when I was growing up that it was okay to call him racist.
Yes.
There wasn't a lot of dispute about it. You know what I'm saying? Like, it was like, well, yeah, kind of, you know. You know, like now there's a dispute over calling people that sort of thing and all that. But like with Jesse Helms, it was sort of like, all right, that dude is on the Mount Rushmore of racism.
Yes. Yes. Like, in fact, I don't even feel like we got anybody truly in the public space, like at senator level or higher. Like, you know, the president makes things tricky, right? Yeah. Because he's the president of the United States. Like, people, you know, get a little reluctant in what they're going to say there. But like, if you get on TV and call Jesse Helms a racist, ain't nobody going to say nothing to you about it. And I think it's in large part because Jesse Helms wouldn't say nothing to you about it. Right? Even like, and the dude, when Carol Moseley Braun got to the Senate.
Yes.
Right. Carol Moseley Braun, the second black senator after Reconstruction, the second one. Jesse Helms in the elevator with her, literally whistling Dixie.
Yep.
In the 1990s.
Yes. Yes. I mean, it's just, it's unfathomable. And I mean, that's why, I mean, this is a little far afield, but when Michael Jordan didn't come out and support Harvey Gantt, like, that's why, it's just like, if you can't side that guy's racist, if you can't come out on the other side of this dude, then when are you ever going to be there? That's right. What that, so much of that was about, right?
The dude who won, and then when he won, the first thing he says to reporters is, there's no joy in Mudville, I mean, and he wasn't talking about Casey at the bat.
Right.
He was talking about us.
Right. It's shocking in retrospect if you think about it. I mean, I guess this is almost 30 years ago, but this was a dude who was like a prominent political figure within the course of our lives. The guy that had like a very powerful platform. And like, we just, that was just how the world was, you know what I'm saying? And I'm not, which is not to say that there are not elements of that in politics today, but just that the guy that was this overt in his antagonism towards, you know, I guess the increasing diversity of America. It's just sort of jarring when you think about it in retrospect.
Right. And so the thing that gets me about Liberty and why I think it's important, they want to use athletics to mainstream what they're doing.
Right.
And the example that I use often about this is BYU.
Yep.
Where their brand of Christianity is viewed as an other brand of Christianity by most of America. I'm not a religious person, so I'm not here to make, you know, too many particular evaluations of how they do things, and you know, over there in particular. But I have made the argument for a very long time that BYU football is the most mainstream representation of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Like it, you know, they go across the country. And wherever they play, they basically sell out, because every Mormon that is living in that place is going to wind up turning up. Like, that's why they were like, we could be an independent, because there would be a demand for them to play wherever it happened to be, right? Because there would be people who would then show up. And I feel like Liberty is trying to use football and basketball to mainstream themselves in a very similar way, except the dilemma for them is, and I guess this is a dilemma to a degree for BYU, is you kind of need black people in order to make this happen.
Right.
Like, you kind of need that. And so BYU, at least Polynesians, like, they have many members of their church are Polynesian. They could fill out the roster with some Polynesian players. They'd recruit black players. Like, I don't want to act like it's that rare that there's a black player at BYU. But people largely believed that BYU was racist and antagonistic toward black folks, right? Like, that sort of thing was going to take some time. That's kind of what Liberty, I feel like, is trying to do over there. And once you get stories like yours, where you started talking to the black athletes that were like, yo, man, I just can't do this anymore. Like, what was it for them that made them say that, you know, I guess not just what made them say they were leaving, but I'm also kind of curious, what made them say they were coming in the first place?
Well, I think one of the things about the story that we get into is that there's a couple of paths into it, right? Like, there are athletes that actually choose Liberty. And in the story, one of them is a women's basketball player named Asia Todd. She was a freshman, really good. She was on the conference all-freshman team, was on the all-tournament team by the end of the year. So had a lot of talent, a lot of promise, was going to be a fixture in the program. And she comes from a family that's very religious. Her father was a pastor. She said that she dreamt that God told her to go to Liberty. So to the extent that you were going to be able to get black athletes to go to Liberty, this is sort of your ideal person. And not long after she's on campus, you know, they've got Candace Owens coming to speak on campus at something they call convocation. It's basically they'll have guests speak to the entire student body, you know, once a week. She comes there. Donald Trump Jr. is there. Nigel Farage is there. And you're hearing all these, like, you know, really sort of incendiary political opinions to some people, to black people, to a lot of black people. And it was around that time, you know, Asia Todd is like, wait, what am I doing here again? Like, why am I here? And the other path into the school was Tavion Land, who was a guy that was a top football recruit out of Virginia, but, you know, not like top 10, but top 20. But he was still like the best recruit that Liberty ever had a chance with. And the only reason they had a chance at him is because his offer from Maryland got pulled away at the last moment. And so that's how he ended up there. And like, he didn't know anything about Liberty, didn't know anything about Jerry Falwell Jr., didn't know anything about Lynchburg, Virginia. He just shows up. The facilities are great. If you go, everybody that goes to Liberty says, oh, the facilities are fantastic. They're the best outside of the Power Five. And when you're 18 years old, you just think, well, I'm just going to ball, and that's going to be all there is. And when you get on campus, you find out it's not necessarily that. And that's what happened to Tavion Land. Like, it wasn't long before he realized, oh, wait a minute, I spent a lot of time outside of the football facility too, and I've got to figure out a way to navigate that. And that was really difficult for him.
That speaks to something that I think is interesting here, is that people need places to play football, or need places to play ball, and they're offering this. But I wonder how much these young people, and in many cases their parents, how aware they are of the school, right? Mm. Like what they know about it going in on the front end. Because I feel like people like you and I who pay attention to things in the political space, we know what's going on here, right? But I'm really wondering how many people just truly have no idea, because I'm finding myself very intrigued by trying to understand how much these guys know in high school and how much their parents know about this larger world.
Well, I'll say for Asia Todd that her father warned her that he's a guy that was like, look, I don't know if this is what you want to do, man. Like, maybe you might want to think of something else. But, you know, they're 18 years old. It's their decision. Ultimately, he deferred to her and let her go. But on the whole, when I was 17, 18 years old, I don't know that I... Well, it was a different time when I was 17, 18, by the way. Like, there just wasn't as much information about colleges. Right. Like, you know, it wasn't a given that you were going to visit college campuses in the way that kids do now, that they get familiar with the environments or whatever. But even still, like, they're 17, 18 years old. They got a lot going on. All they know is they go to campus. They see a couple other brothers on the team. You know what I'm saying? The football facility is nice. And they're just like, well, I can do this. But they don't have to know anything about Jerry Falwell Jr. until they're actually there. And then that's when the problems come. But I don't know about you, but like when I went to TCU, I'll never forget. I went on a visit there, and I didn't see a lot of black people there, and I didn't see a lot of girls there neither. But I was just like, it's college, so it'll be fine, you know. Right. I was like, it'll be somebody here, you know what I'm saying? And I'm not saying that like I had a bad time at TCU, but if I had known a little bit more about the world out there, so to speak, that maybe I might have made a different decision. And I think that's probably true for a lot of 17 and 18 year olds.
Yeah, well, I always say about Liberty too, and I think this is the thing that people got to keep track of, is Virginia has some real weird geography when it comes to where the best colleges are to play ball. Ooh. And where the best football players are. Ooh. Right?
Yes.
They're not close to each other.
No.
Right? Like the whole state is kind of no man's land. Like Mac Brown has come back in North Carolina. And when Mac was winning at North Carolina before, he did it off players from the Tidewater, because the Tidewater is basically about as close to Chapel Hill as it is to Charlottesville, and closer than it is to Virginia Tech. Absolutely. After Mac left, Virginia Tech went and kind of took over the recruiting in the Tidewater. Like that's where they ended up, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it used to be that the closest FBS school to the Tidewater was East Carolina. East Carolina got Michael Vick on campus for a visit.
Which is just crazy, right?
Which is crazy. But it's
crazy.
It was the closest school.
Right.
Right? Like that was it. It was the closest school. And so there are all these good football players in Virginia. The geography is not good for the big time Virginia schools. So you've seen these schools pop up that used to be FCS become an FBS because they realize we can get some players here, right?
Old Dominion.
Old Dominion. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like they popped up and they're like, we could do this. And so Liberty, I think they looked up and they were like, wait a minute, this is our chance.
Mm-hmm.
We got an opportunity to make this happen. And I wonder for Liberty what it's going to be now that the landscape of college football seems to be changing a bit.
The one thing that I think that can help Liberty is that they got a lot of money, man, and they can wait it out. You know what I'm saying? Like where a lot of schools that are running out of money, running short in this time during the pandemic, it's going to be really difficult for them. But Liberty has all the money in the world. You know what I mean? Like they can sort of wait it out. And I could envision a scenario 15, 20 years from now that things are totally different, that people are looking at, you know, maybe Jerry Falwell Jr. isn't in charge anymore. And we've sort of been mainstreamed by the idea that Liberty is a FBS playing school. I mean, they're playing, I think this year, Syracuse, Virginia Tech, and NC State. So we're just going to get used to the idea that they play these other schools. They're just going to become part of the landscape eventually. And I could totally see, it used to be weird to see BYU, I'm sure, like in the 1980s, if you were a football fan and you saw BYU, you know, up there at the top of the rankings, it probably was weird. But after a while, we sort of got used to the idea that BYU is a national player now.
Yeah, and I do also think, I imagine that there's some people that look at Liberty and they're like, people like, yo, man, I don't think you want to go there, man. I hear it's racist over there, da, da, da. But the thing is, so now I'm going to go to the University of Virginia?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, I mean, dude, I saw an interview with one of the Liberty recruits, and he basically said, well, man, I might have to deal with this anyway. You know what I'm saying? Like, he's air places racist. Yes. And I was like, some places are more racist than others, but I see your point.
Yeah. Like the difference with Liberty is that whatever they're doing, the ideology is clearly starts from the top and then it goes down, right? Like this isn't one of those where it's just like the world's been this or whatever and it's a system, you know, and it's all these things that are going around. No, no, no. The ideology of Liberty starts at the top,
right?
And then goes down. The other hilarious thing for me about Liberty is I mean, they hired Hugh Freeze, right? So I want to fully appreciate them hiring Hugh Freeze, who lost his last job because he was calling escorts on the company phone on recruiting trips while he was at Ole Miss.
Right,
okay.
Right. Well, Tampa will do that to you, bro.
Yeah, yep. That's shady Tampa. Man, Jeff Garrett. I was talking about a shady Tampa. But was Turner Gill the coach before him, or was there one coach in between?
Turner Gill was the coach right before him.
Okay. Turner Gill, part of why it didn't work for him at Kansas, among other things, was Turner Gill was trying to get the players to agree to not see women after dark, right? Not have women in their rooms. What he thought the rules. Dude, you at Kansas, man. It's hard enough to get them there.
I mean, and then you're going to tell them you can't do that? I mean, come on.
Bro. Oh, come on, man. It lasted for 2 years for him. But then he wound up going to Liberty, which absolutely seemed to be a school in line with his values, right? Mm-hmm. It seemed like a perfect fit. And then after he left, they went and got the dude who just lost his job for calling hookers on the work phone.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the thing is that, you know, and Hugh Freeze has sort of skirted around the idea that anything untoward happened. He just makes vague references to what went down, but he doesn't cop to anything specific, right? So he's just, I lost my way. Well, fine, whatever. But, you know, the thing is, and if you look at the way that this all happened, Falwell invited Freeze onto campus the year before to speak at one of those convocations. And so Freeze gives this testimony. And it was right then that basically Falwell says, if this dude is ever available, if we ever have an opening, we're getting that dude. He fits with their ethos, right?
Yep.
Liberty doesn't have to be embarrassed about anything as long as Jerry Falwell is there. You know what I mean? Like, they're a program in an institution that's sort of beyond shame as long as that guy is there. He can do anything, say anything. He had some bizarre pictures that turned up on the internet this week. And it's just like, that's just Liberty. You know what I'm saying? And it's sort of ingenious in a way, because you can just sort of degrade the public conversation and just sort of degrade your reputation and just be like, well, that's just him. And there's nothing you can really do about it, right? So, yeah. But it is weird that they made that 180 after Turner Gill.
He's the better coach they could ever get. Yes, that's all that came down to.
Best coach that they could get. That's why they got Ian McCaw as the athletic director, because they looked around and they were just like, who else are we going to get better than him? We might as well get him.
Right. Ian McCaw, the former athletic director at Baylor, when everything went bad there.
They got him months after he left Baylor under those circumstances. It's not like he had a chance to do like a, you know, an apology tour or to make amends or anything. They brought him in months after he left Baylor under those circumstances.
And you know what, though? The Baylor guys, they all obviously should have been fired, right? Or, you know, let go however it went. I got no dispute on that. However, every time Art Briles has gotten up and told somebody they scapegoated me, I look at that and I say, you are 100% correct.
Fair.
Right? Because they got some much larger issues at Baylor that are tied to the same exact thing. And they absolutely did try to act like it was all the football team's fault. They put all of that off on Briles.
Absolutely. I mean, also, I mean, every time, I mean, I don't want to say every time, but in the last 20 years, every time Baylor has gotten good at something, there's been some like ridiculous scandal, you know, attached. And Art Briles wasn't there for that. Ian McCaw was brought in after the Patrick Dennehy scandal. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, I mean, it's not like Baylor has clean hands in any of this. Every time they want to get good, they got to play a little bit. You know, so they got to play a little dirty, you know?
Yeah. But you know, the other part of it is, man, white man get the benefit of the doubt. Like, that's what it really came down to with McCaw, with Freeze, all these cats. The white man gets the benefit of the doubt. You have a chance to have learned your lesson. And the path that Freeze took was to give his testimony. And that always works. Right? Like that crowd, that one always works. But that's what it is. All these cats just kept getting the benefit of the doubt. And I feel like it's being extended to Liberty in a much larger sense. Because if we drop them off on television and people start, you know, talking about their games or whatever, we're not going to make any mention to what the larger things are that are around that program. And that's exactly what they want, right? Oh. It's almost like they found the glitch in the matrix, where they're just kind of like, yo, they're over there sticking to sports. So we could throw these sports up there, even though you and I, there's no way that we look at Liberty, you know, and not think about the bigger things.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They're counting on them becoming mainstream. And I mean, they have explicitly said, this is something that Jerry Falwell Sr. and Jr. have said, that they look at Notre Dame and BYU as the model. That is their model. That is something they want to emulate. They want to become the home team for millions of believers. And I mean, I don't see any evidence that they can't do it, you know, at this point. It's going to be hard if they antagonize black people like that, though. Like, they may not be good. They may be prominent, but they may not be good. And that's going to be the real difficulty there.
Here's what it'll come down to. You can get black people. You can even get black people who are good under this. But what's the catch going to be? You know what I'm saying? Like if you're doing this, I mean, it's the same thing we talking about with Baylor. Like, the thing about Baylor is in Waco, Texas, man. Ooh. Ain't nobody really trying to do that. Ooh. That's just what it comes down to. Ain't nobody trying to do that. And to win at Baylor, what you can't do is start whittling away the pool of recruits for non-football reasons, right? No matter how good a non-football reason it is, every reason that you don't take a recruit that isn't about football is making your football team worse.
Right.
So they do some looking around and be like, yeah, I guess we'll take them, you know, and then we'll go from there. Like, they can get some dudes, but it's going to be another story that we're reading about. Like, you think about Nebraska. Did you know this about Johnny Rogers? You're familiar with Johnny Rogers, 1972 Heisman Trophy winner. Did you know that he got convicted of a felony while he was at Nebraska?
I did not know that. What?
He got convicted of robbing a gas station.
Oh, my God.
Of robbing a gas station. Now, who knows, man? Right? White man might have been lying. You know what I mean? It might not have been as bad as they say. I don't know what it is. But in the 1970s, he caught a felony for robbing a gas station and still got to play there. You know why? Because Nebraska can't be turning dudes down for non-football reasons.
Bob Delaney and Tom Osborne, they were like, look, man, do y'all want to win or not?
Right.
What do you want to do here? If we're going to do this, we're going to do it.
Well, that's what I always thought would have happened at North Carolina, right? Mm-hmm. And not much of that actually had to do with the coaches, at least the stuff that was out there. But after it all happened at North Carolina, I just imagine Butch Davis walking in being like, my bad, y'all. I thought y'all said y'all wanted to win.
Right. No, I mean, it's real. I mean, you have to, if you're going to be competitive, if you're not, if you don't have recruiting advantages, if you don't have tradition, if you don't have, you know, you're not that program, if you're not Georgia, if you're not LSU, then it's just like, hey, bro, I mean, if we don't get him, somebody else going to get him. So we might as well be on our team.
Yo, let me Google this, because I've looked at this list before. Most times on NCAA probation football. This list is always hilarious to see who's been on probation the most times. Now, this list was compiled in 2012. Yes, I think Houston is going to come up with it. I am pretty sure, because that is my favorite school to point to as, like, we going to do whatever it takes in order to win.
Well, did you know that Miami was like a prestigious, like hard to get in school? Did you know that? I didn't know that until like I was older, by the way.
Oh, no. I didn't know it until I was an adult.
Yeah, okay.
Here's what's interesting about Miami. Miami, as black as the football program was, and maybe it's because they always had a white dude play a quarterback, Miami never got to the point, though, of Georgetown and Temple, where we thought that those were black colleges.
Right. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Like, how old were you when you found out that Georgetown wasn't an HBCU?
I mean, dude, when they did the little kente cloth joints around the edge of the jersey, I'm like, oh, okay, you know, what's up? And the cheers during the games, man, the Hoyas cheer, I was kind of like, that kind of sounds like CSU or Prairie View. You know what I'm saying?
I know for a fact. I was 13 when I learned that Georgetown was not an HBCU, because I told my parents I wanted to go to Georgetown, and they explained to me that it wasn't an HBCU.
It's so far from being an HBCU too, by the way.
It's so far. Otherwise, I would have had no idea. Cass told me they thought Temple was an HBCU, and I fully got why they thought Temple was an HBCU, because they play games on a court with all the volleyball lines on it. You know what I'm saying? Like, I was like, yeah, that's an HBCU kind of move that y'all are making.
And John Chaney kind of also, I don't know how to explain it. He looked like an HBCU coach. I don't know how to explain it.
Because he was out here coaching in like a short sleeve dress shirt. Right. You know what I'm saying? And he gave all HBCU vibes.
Oh,
like his whole thing. Like, or at the very least, that didn't look like a man no white folks will hire.
How did that happen? That's what I'm saying. I want to know what he looked like 30, 40 years ago. You know what I'm saying?
Well, you know the thing with Chaney was Chaney coached at Chaney State.
Oh.
That was his job. He won like national championships at Chaney State before that. And so my read on that has always been that Temple was not really trying to play the game.
Right.
You know what I mean? That wasn't the way that they were trying to do it. And so he was perfect. You know, he's local. You know, if you try to run a local program, basically, he was the perfect guy for it. Oh, my God. John Chaney was the man at Chaney State.
Oh, I did not know that. Oh,
I mean, they're in Division II. Like, these are the last years he had at Chaney State. Elite Eight, national championship. Woo. Third place, Elite Eight. Ooh. So I feel like he was kind of like Ohio State hiring Jim Tressel.
Yeah. Who's other? Was Butch Jones sort of like that? Although Butch Jones, it didn't quite work out for him, but he like worked that ladder. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like,
you worked it up.
You went here.
Mm-hmm. But what's funny about what Georgetown had to HBCU, we had the kente cloth.
Yeah.
But the thing was, everybody had the kente cloth. Like, that was what Nike was doing. But with Georgetown, it looked like it was supposed to be there. Texas A&M had Kente cloth on the jersey. I can't imagine what they told the white folks that was.
Well, you know, I got kind of confused about Texas A&M a little bit too growing up.
I did too.
I was kind of like, I thought it was a little bit more, you know.
A little bit? Just a little?
Just a little bit more. I was like, you know, Quinn Corey, yeah, bro. I mean, just, if you just told me, I wouldn't have been able to figure out the dissonance there.
Yeah. I went to school with enough I want to be Aggies to get a handle on what time it was going on. But I remember we took a trip my senior year. We went to the library up there. Because you got to remember, my high school is maroon and white. Aggie War Hymn is the fight song. Like, I went to school in Aggie Land.
Y'all
like,
are right up the street from it, too.
Yeah.
40 minutes?
It's more than 40 minutes?
Okay.
It's a drive. Like, it's there, but it's a rural agricultural area. And therefore, the Aggies is what they gravitate toward. Mm-hmm. But I remember we went there for a visit, and I was like, oh, no way. No chance.
Oh, they didn't fool you and take you there during Southwest Black Leadership Conference?
No, because this is a different kind of trip.
Okay.
Like, this was a trip for my school. Like, we were going to go use the library to work on our research papers.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no. I didn't get caught on that. I know a lot of people. People don't know this. Whole lot of black folks, a lot of these schools that you look at, you're like, damn, I'm surprised these black people came here. It's because they all visited on the same weekend.
They tricked you. Yeah, because that's what happened to me at A&M. I was like, oh, okay, this is what it's like, huh? All right, I seen you. Nah, it's not like that at all.
Not even close. This happens so many different types of places where you get there after, like, yo, like the first weekend be cracking, you know, and then like September 13th, you're like, dog, where the hell am I?
Yeah, what happened? Right? Where's everybody? Right.
When I was in Claremont, they said that happened, that they all came to visit on the same weekend.
Because
Claremont had them five schools, right? They're all really small. Mm-hmm. And so if you get a couple hundred black people in to visit for the weekend, they was all like, yeah, let's do it. Let's all come here. And then they got back and was like, yo, where the black people? It's all the people you knew before you got here, baby.
Colleges have perfected this. So, like, you know, they got to figure out. If they are trying, they figure it out. You know what I'm saying? But they can't sustain it. And that's when people get upset. You know what I mean?
Yes. No, but definitely go to Slate.com. Check out Joel's story on Liberty University. I think it's really interesting and really important one. So go ahead and check that out. You are based in the Bay.
Yep.
You and I have been talking a lot about what's going on with the Pac-12 players.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Big 12 players, just generally what's going on. You are a former college athlete. So, like, what's been your read on what's happening here?
I think that there has been a simmering discontent from players for a very long time. And they know their value. You know, they've gradually come to sort of understand that. People have talked about it publicly in ways that we just didn't 20, 25 years ago. So it was eventually going to come to a head. They're just like, well, we know that we're valuable. How can we tap into that value? And finally, there's an opportunity that has emerged, right? And then also, I think that another thing is that I don't know that players, like people, it's hard to sort of articulate, but like players don't necessarily trust their programs to look out for their best interests, even in the best of times. You know what I mean? Like, you don't know if your coach cares about you outside of a football facility or these programs care about you outside of that. And so when this pandemic hits, all of this comes home. You know, all of it, you know, you can kind of get your arms around all of it. It's like, okay, they need us to get out here. Now they're telling us our value. Like, we know it's clear as day right now. And also, you're depending on people that you don't necessarily trust to look out for your injuries or to care about your academic career, any of this other stuff. And you're putting your trust totally in these coaches and totally in these programs. And it's just like, well, wait, are we sure that they're looking out for us in the middle of this pandemic? Are they really protecting us? Are they really looking out for our best interests? And so you can understand how these players like looked around and they were like, maybe we should talk about this with somebody. Maybe we need to have a conversation with these guys so that we can make sure that our interests are being looked out for.
And what I think is interesting is that all the guys that I've talked to, with the exception of the Washington State guys, and even then, they kind of fall in this category. I got no resentment from any of these guys toward their coaches. And in fact, in many cases, it sounded like their coaches were on board with them and understood, you know, where it was that they were coming from. And a lot of these guys even said themselves, I think our school is doing everything that they can do to keep us safe. And I have gotten information to the contrary about some of these places and some of these schools and talked to some of these players.
Right.
And they wouldn't give it up on the schools. Right. Like, they're still not going there. but they just look around and see the macro level situation and they can't trust it. Yeah. Right. Like they recognize everybody's getting paid off of them playing. And so whether or not they play has nothing to do with them. It has everything to do with whether or not people are going to get paid. Right. You know, like I think an important point in this is that these cats ain't resentful. These cats ain't mad.
Right.
They just scared.
And they should be, because who is specifically looking out for their interests in all of this stuff? Right. Like all these people are in the rooms making schedules, laying out protocols, doing all these guidelines. How often are the players actually in the room? And I think it's just, they're like, we should have some sort of a say here. Like, shouldn't we be involved in these conversations? And like, at the bottom line, I mean, it's a reasonable ask to say, hey, we want to be shaping some of these conversations and protecting ourselves and making sure that our interests are looked out for here as well. Not that you're not, but we at least want to make sure that like our piece is spoken in these meetings. And I think that's eminently fair. I was thinking about the story that ran in the Washington Post over the weekend, those SEC guys. And it was just like, yo, man, y'all just going to have to accept it. Some of y'all going to get sick. And I mean, the players are like, wait a minute, you talking about me getting sick, though.
Right. You
know?
Right.
Like, this isn't theoretical. You're talking about me getting sick. What about, you know what I'm saying? So, like, I can totally understand why these guys are just looked up and they're like, we should have a role in these discussions. And if anybody has a disagreement with that, and so far, publicly, we've only seen one coach who seems to have an issue with it. In all fairness. And so like, yeah, I mean, you can totally see how we ended up here, how we're sort of at an impasse, even though the Big Ten players haven't said they're going to sit out, which is, you know, man.
Right.
What you going to get done if you don't sit out?
Well, because the Big Ten guys are playing a different game. Mm. I talked to Hunter Reynolds last night of their group. And the difference is they're working cooperatively.
Okay.
They are seeking to work with the Big Ten in order to make sure that all these things get done. The Pac-12 guys are like, not possible.
Wow.
That's the thing. The Pac-12 guys are like, nah, that's not going to work. And to be fair, I think the Pac-12 guys are probably closer to right on this. Now, what you might be able to do in the Big Ten is besides the positive PR and have it out there that we're all working together. And then that's the way that you move toward getting all the health and safety protocols and all the things that they say that they want. That's with the Big Ten guys. The Pac-12 guys, they're a little more jaded and a bit more disillusioned on the idea. If these people weren't doing right by you to begin with, then they're not going to cooperate with you to do right now. Otherwise, you wouldn't have had to ask them to do it. They would have been coming to cooperate with you in the first place if that sort of thing was really going to happen. Now, the Pac-12 thing also has the added thing where they're talking about compensation,
right?
Where the Big Ten players are not, right? Like, these are two different things.
Did you get a sense for why they're not asking for compensation?
They just did not think that that was a pressing matter right now. There were guys in the Pac-12 who did not think of that as being a pressing matter. So the way that I take that is the Big Ten guys are working on the right now. Mm-hmm. The scope of the Pac-12 movement thereby is ultimately broader and looking at something larger that's going on down the line. The Big Ten guys got different advisors behind them. That is the read that I had. But the Big Ten guys think that adding compensation, this is my read. No one told me this explicitly. Mm-hmm. But the Big Ten guys think that adding compensation kind of muddies it and probably will make it less likely that people are going to be on your side. My argument against that is you ask for the Big Ten network so that your parents could watch you.
Mm-hmm.
And cats like Doug Gottlieb still popped up and were like, there you go, looking for free stuff. Like, no matter what you asked for, it was going to wind up being not enough. And that's why I look at the Pac-12 and people are like, well, you're never going to get that. All right, then tell us no. But we're asking for it.
Yeah, well, that's kind of thing. And also, like, why waste a crisis? You know what I'm saying? Where they say never waste a crisis. Well, this is the opportunity to get in those asks. And we just can't come to the table. And if they don't want to pay him, fine. You know what I'm saying? Or maybe we could come up with some sort of other agreement. But yeah, I mean, if you don't ask for it now, Big Ten players, it ain't going to happen. You know what I mean? Because things are going to get back to normal. You guys aren't going to be there in 2 or 3 years. And then the cycle starts itself over again. I mean, maybe I'm a little bit more radical and I'm a West Coast guy now, you know what I'm saying? So
I
feel what those kids are talking about a little bit more, but I also understand where the Big Ten is coming from, that football players want to play football. Like, you know, it's crazy because people are pretending that like these football players are throwing up these obstacles or something because they don't want to play or because they're entitled or whatever. No, these dudes want to play football, man. It's important to them.
They absolutely do, because I talked to 3 players from Washington State after the opt-out. Mm. None of them sounded happy.
Yeah.
Right? Like, they've all opted out for varying reasons, but none of them sounded happy. And I think part of what speaks to the skewed power dynamic, and this is the conclusion I drew from talking to the Washington State guys and other guys at different points that I talked to in this, communication between programs and players is bad. Bad. So much of this could be cleared up with better communication just between coaches and players. And I know the difficulty with a lot of the coaches is the roster's too big.
Right.
Like, there's only so much that you can talk to all the players. Like, there's limitations in how far you can go on that. But I hear a lot of these things. Man, the communication in these programs with these players is so, so bad. And it's bad in part because the schools don't really feel no obligation to inform anybody of anything. And so the players are largely in the dark. Like, a lot of how these group chats came about is the players feel like the schools aren't telling them what the deal is with COVID and anything else. So they had to cull together all the information themselves. They're trading links.
Yeah.
They're keeping each other, like, up on game.
Right. And, I mean, this is part of a long tradition of coaches and programs not feeling like they have to talk with the players as equal partners in this, right? I mean, if they were equal partners, then we would be talking about compensation as something that is not so far-fetched, right? But they've never thought of them as equal partners in this arrangement. And so why would they talk to them? And the coaches don't think that they have to talk to their players as equal, which maybe there's some merit to that. But in the end, eventually there's going to be some suspicion as to why we're not involved in these discussions. And so, like, mistrust gets bred. And hey, like, that's how you end up with guys saying, well, hold on, man, all this stuff stops until we have a conversation about how this is going to get arranged.
Right. And my thing is, I don't even think you even necessarily need to talk to them as equals. You just need to talk to them as adults.
Yeah.
Because my man Rod always makes the point. Black guy who tips. Check out his podcast. He always makes the point. They treat them like kids when it's time to pay them, but they sure treat them like they're grown when something goes wrong.
Oh, yeah. That's a great point.
You know,
yeah.
when they make a mistake or they wind up getting arrested for whatever reason or any of that stuff, once that happens, oh, all of a sudden they're all grown. Now they're not people that need to be listened to. And what I want to see from the players in this is who's down to not play.
Yeah.
Right. Like, that's what it's going to come down to, because with Andrew Cooper, one of the guys that's working with the Pac-12 players, he made the point in the story that I wrote for The Undefeated. He said one thing he learned is you can't start a labor movement without a work stoppage.
Yeah. I mean, that's absolutely true. And even circling back to your point in terms of the benefit of the doubt, how they treat the players like adults, like the coaches. They can observe how they've handled the chaos of the last few months. And a lot of coaches have made missteps, from Ferentz to Dabo to Gary Patterson. And they just want people to accept their apologies, like, immediately. There's no accountability. Like, they get all of the deference and grace that players never do. And I could imagine that over time, players noticing that and being like, wait a minute, they're supposed to be adults. They're supposed to be leaders of these multi-million dollar organizations. And all they have to do is say, I'm sorry, and everybody moves on, and they're supposed to accept that. And they're like, no, like, it's time for you guys to take some responsibility for some of these things as well.
Gary Patterson, who you did not play for directly, but he was defensive coordinator when you in your last year at TCU. he used the N-word around the players, which is, you know, I thought we all understood.
A poor choice. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You don't do that. And he went and apologized to the players the next day. And it was one of those where I say this all the time, where we report the apology, but we never reported the thing was that happened in the first place. Like, it wasn't a big enough deal that he did it. But then when he apologizes, now we'll go tell everybody. That'll make it on the top headlines part of the website that he went and he apologized. And I just can't understand how Gary Patterson has coached as long as he has. And by the way, coach the players that he coaches, right? Because yeah. That's a dude that can't afford to be out here like only honor roll students for me.
All right.
You know, like, he doesn't have that option in recruiting at TCU. And, bro, you don't know that you can't do that?
I just, you know, the way that I think about it and the way I've rationalized it is that Gary Patterson, and I don't want to pretend to say that I know him or that I'm close to him or that we've even spoken in many years, that he's got a statue on campus right now. He's used to running his program in the way that he has and saying things to players in the way that he has. And so there's not been a lot of accountability for the way that he's treated these players. I mean, just keep in mind, like, the racial slur was a very offensive part of it, but he also told the kid that I'll send you back to Pitt.
That I thought was the worst part, to Pittsburgh, Kansas.
Yeah, Pittsburgh, Kansas. I mean, that is really offensive. And what are you saying? What do you think of a kid when you tell him that I can control your future? I can just send you back home. That's where you're going to go. To me, that speaks to, like, you don't have a lot of respect for at least that kid. I'm not going to say all the other kids, but you don't have a lot of respect for that kid. So you can't expect him to respect you in return.
The only reason to me that that is not a fireable offense is that they'd have to fire everybody.
Yeah, they do that all the time.
Yeah, like, that's the thing. They do, like, this came up with Mike Gundy.
Mm-hmm.
This came up in the Iowa situation. And with Patterson, and this also, I think, applies to these other two schools, too. Again, they don't really have the option of getting, like, the best of the best when it comes to recruiting. The thing I thought with Patterson that made this even more problematic is what a lot of people know him for, and part of what has made him uniquely successful, is his ability to identify good players with bad nutrition.
Ooh.
Right? Like what happens with a lot of these schools that are at that level is they find guys who've never gotten 3 square meals a day, right? Mm-hmm. Like they get these undersized dudes and then put them on a nutrition program for the first time in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden they become new people. Yeah, like they become entirely new athletes as a result. And I'm not saying that Gary Patterson is intentionally going and picking out poor kids to recruit to control them. But if the guys you're getting are guys who have never gotten 3 square meals in their lives before,
mm-hmm.
then you're going to have more power over them than you would over the kid whose dad played in the NFL or whatever it is. Like Patterson, even if he's not intentionally doing it for this reason, is getting guys that you can say, don't make me send you back to wherever it was that you were from.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of like East Texas. I mean, a lot of their recruiting ground is East Texas, North Louisiana. I mean, these aren't places that are, you know, known for, you know, being wealthy, you know, wealthy enclaves or anything. He has a lot of power in this situation, even more so than most other coaches, because, again, he has a statue built there. This is probably the best TCU has ever been since the 1930s. Like, he's got a big infrastructure around him that insulates him from criticism or really any danger or any threat of being fired. So he could treat these guys however. And I would just remind people that it was only last year when the star receiver, Colby Listenbee, settled a suit with TCU over allegations of abuse and harassment. You know what I mean? And the people thought that that guy was sort of ridiculous and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, it's not like this is the first time that people have alleged that there's been, I mean, for lack of a better term, a hostile workplace environment at TCU. And you hope that Coach Patterson learned something from this. He's a smart guy. He's done well. There are a lot of people that love him. You know, I don't want to impugn him or his, you know, his reputation there. But you would hope that he learned something from this and doesn't just say it, that he thinks that an apology is the only way that you can get out of this.
And I understand that, I mean, Gary Patterson helped chart the course of your life.
Yeah, right. Yeah, he sent me to journalism, man. You know what I'm saying?
What did he tell you?
He told me I had feet like an offensive lineman or something like that. And I was a running back, so of course that was unfortunate. And I never forget some of the guys told me, they're like, man, they're going to probably move you to safety. During that spring, a bunch of guys had gotten hurt at defensive back. And, you know, TCU runs that 4-2-5, so they need a lot of defensive back. And when I heard I might get moved to safety, I was like, oh, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not playing safety, bro. I'm sorry. I don't love football that much. So thank you, Coach Patterson. You helped me find my true passion in life.
Well, I was talking to a homie yesterday, and he said you tell the story also that you realized it wasn't going to work for you when LaDainian Tomlinson showed up and he enjoyed practice.
Oh, yeah. Man, LaDainian Tomlinson, he does know where he remembers this. He was yelling at me in one of our workouts. I don't know what happened. I'd been sick, joined workouts after a week, and I was just dragging ass, as they call it. And LaDainian Tomlinson was looking, I'll just never forget him looking at me down the line, and he was just like, man, what's up, bro? What you know, just yelling at me about, like, no, I'm not holding up my end of the deal. And I was like, oh, man, this is what it takes, huh? This is what it's going to be like. it can't be this way. I don't love football that much. I don't like working out that much. So
I still don't understand how he ever wound up at TCU. Like, did something happen to him in high school?
He didn't get a lot of carries until his senior year. He was the fullback his junior year. There was another guy that was a running back who went to JUCO.
Who was he?
I mean, he was apparently he was okay. I feel like his name was Leroy Coleman or something. Like, I don't know why I remember this. And then LaDainian finally got carries his senior year, and he had like this big 2,500-yard season his senior year. But by that time, you know how it is. I mean, he's in Waco. There were a lot of other top recruits or whatever. I think his choices were like Baylor, TCU, Kansas State, a couple other places. He definitely did not get those big offers, though.
I'm just saying, while Hodges Mitchell was out here logging these carries, it could have been LaDainian. We could have LaDainian Tomlinson backing up Ricky Williams for 2 years.
I mean, that's the thing. I hate to admit it, but if most TCU guys get that UT offer, they probably going to go to UT.
Every single one of you.
I don't know about every single one.
There's not a one of y'all that's there because y'all wanted to be.
I mean, TCU is like, what, 8 out of the last 10 over UT? Is that right? Something like
correct.
That?
Okay. Absolutely.
All right. So, I mean, some people just want to go to a winning program.
Yeah. I hear you. I understand that. You understand that what I'm saying is awesome. That was my thing, though, with the dude at Wazoo. He acting up. I'm like, dog, there ain't a single dude on your roster who's there because he wanted to be.
Whoa, Nick Rose.
Right?
I mean, everybody, what are you doing?
Everybody got a but as to why they wound up going there.
No recruit who has aspirations of playing in the NFL has Wazoo listed as a number one choice. It doesn't start right out that way. You know what I'm saying? So why would you antagonize, dude? Like, why would you be that guy, put that on your neck? You can do that in Hawaii. You know what I mean? I feel like you can do that. That's kind of far enough out of the way. If Wazoo is going to come a little bit more into focus, and it's just like, well, how you going to get dudes up here, bro, if you known as that dude?
Doug, and the players said that they talked to him weeks ago and it seemed like it was all good. Mm. And then once it went down this time, it was like something flipped.
Yeah, man.
And they had no idea. This does make me wonder, though. Like, if Hawaii offers you a scholarship, you got to keep them in your top five till the end, right?
Well, I mean, somebody told me about this many years ago that, like, because a lot of people do use Hawaii like that. It was like, yo, they want that fifth trip to Hawaii. And it's kind of like, essentially, if you commit to them, you got to commit to them before you go on a visit.
Something I'll do that. I heard this. That's fine.
Yeah, right.
Whatever.
Yeah, right. But I mean, it's like, it's kind of crazy because if you have like Hawaii, USC, you know, Alabama on your list, it's like, nah, bro, I don't know if you're really serious about this, you know?
Maybe I am. Maybe I'm not. Right? But if I'm a three-star recruit, I'm sending my tape off to Hawaii.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Can't wait. Let me just come on out. Let me just get the camp. You know what I'm saying?
I've always wanted to be a rainbow warrior. What was my man's name? Timmy Chang?
Oh, Timmy Chang. Yeah, man.
Not to be confused with Timmy Chang's.
Yeah, right.
I think I did. I called him Chang. Like, I made him Timmy Chang and Timmy Chan all at one time.
Oh, yeah. People from Houston know we talk about the Timmy Chans. You know what I'm saying? Yes. And I hope they made it through the pandemic, but I don't know.
Yeah, no, let me tell you, it's going to take a lot more than that to shut down Timmy Chan. I mean, Finch is still rolling, right?
Man, you know, they had to move off campus because Wheeler Avenue Baptist took their parking lot, so I think they moved down the street somewhere.
Okay.
I hope they're doing okay. Frenchies has made it through much worse, so I assume that they'll still be there when we get back home.
By the way, before I forget this, because we mentioned it a little bit earlier, and I do want to come back to it because I think it's low-key one of the more fascinating things about college football, which is the athletic history of the University of Houston. Ooh. Like, nobody really talks about this. So the University of Houston was founded in like 1929 or something like that. They started playing football in the 1940s. It is a big, giant school, right? It's like one of those used to be a commuter schools. It's now like, it's really in line with like USF, UCF, Florida Atlantic, FIU, like all of those. Big, giant, 40, 50,000 student type schools or whatever. But the alums at Houston, very similar to like SMU, they really want to be good, right? And in case you're wondering, why is Houston not in the Big 12? It's very simple. All they do is make things harder for Texas, period.
Texas don't want that.
Because they're not adding anything, right? Mm-hmm. They're not adding anybody watching on television. And all they're doing is taking players. And so Houston really wants to be good. So what Houston has been is ahead of the curve on integration at just about every level, right?
Guy like B. Lewis, Bill Young, Guy all B. those Lewis, guys. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Right, they all were like first black player in the region type stuff.
Right.
Both, like U of H has just been like, yo, this is what we're going to do. Bill Yeoman invented the option.
Yep.
Like the Veer option, he invented this thing because they want to be good so bad. And damn it, they've been caught with some real cheating. They had Bill Yeoman in the 80s, they said, was in the locker room handing out envelopes at the Astrodome after games. Yeah. Yes.
My kind of coach. I'm so proud that I rooted for U of H growing up. You know what I'm saying?
Handing out the envelope. And it was hard to root for U of H growing up because they wasn't on TV because they was on probation.
Andre Ward won the Heisman. I don't think he was on national TV at all that year.
Forget national TV. They weren't on TV.
Right. Yeah.
They could not play a single game on television.
It's crazy.
Because U of H is like, yo, we got to make this happen. And when they played this clean, they wasn't winning nothing.
Oh, yeah. They always, I mean, man, you know who helped rebuild that program, right?
Tillman Fertitta.
Well, yeah. I was going to say Art Browse.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Art Browse.
Art came to win.
Yeah, man. I mean, they have to do things a little different down there because U of H is not, it's not like the 80s. When I was growing up, U of H had Akeem Olajuwon, Clyde Drexler.
Right.
All these other, you know, Andre Ware, all these other cats. It ain't like that no more. So U of H is not necessarily the first choice for people. So they got to figure out ways to be, you know, around the edges, you know.
Their probation shut them down, and then they couldn't get into the Big 12.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they joined the Southwest Conference in 1976 and went to the Cotton Bowl the first 2 years.
Yeah, man, that's crazy.
Because they came to play, man. They like, what do we have to do?
Right. Well, I mean, man, and, you know, now that I'm thinking about it, when the Big 12 lit TCU in, there was a lot of belief that they were also going to get into the Big 12. Because remember when the Big 12 was going to expand and they brought in TCU, the thought was that maybe U of H might get in there. Nah, it didn't go down that way. And so they're still kind of floundering a little bit. I mean, they're doing well. They do good hiring. You can win there. But UT is never going to share a conference with them again if they can help it.
No, they can't. They can't, especially now that Fertitta's out here throwing around $4 million a year to get a head coach.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah.
Which is what he did. Hold on, man. And their real concern is dudes from Houston love one thing more than anything else in this world.
Houston.
Yeah. Houston. Nothing more. If you tell dudes from Houston that they don't have to leave, they're not going anywhere.
Man, bro. U of H kind of, well, we were talking about the HBCU feel. You know what I'm saying? Like, you couldn't have been confused growing up about what it was. But if you go over to U of H, it's right over there in the hood. You know what I'm saying? It's right next to TSU. And it's always had, you know, black representation. You know what I'm saying? So you can go to U of H and have a good time.
Yeah.
And feel, you can be amongst your folks. You don't, you're not going to feel like you're isolated like you are at a lot of other college campuses or whatever.
And again, they were taking black players when nobody else was.
Right.
Like, they have a different legacy in that regard. Like, what makes North Carolina basketball, what made it a juggernaut for so long, was where we're talking about this with Houston.
Yeah.
That's what North Carolina was. Because Dean Smith just came in one day and said, things about change, guys. Charlie Scott, he's coming with me. And I dare you to say, oh, you're not going to say a word.
Right.
That's right. And so they always had that legacy, plus having all the advantages and everything else.
Right.
So imagine if Texas had been out in front on all these things in the ways that Houston was. Texas would never lose a game.
It's so hard to explain to people growing up in Texas that, like, there was this, if you're a black person from Texas, UT was just sort of, you always thought of it as sort of antagonistic towards black folks. They had that legacy of, you know, having the last all-white national championship team in 1969. But I remember reading a story in 1997 about James Brown. You remember quarterback James Brown?
Beaumont
Westbrook's own. Yeah, and they talked about the fact that as a quarterback at UT, that it would help them with recruiting and getting more black kids onto campus. This is 1997, bro. I was a sophomore in college that year. So it's like UT has sort of had to work past its reputation, fair or not, in all these years. Mm-hmm. But if they had been out ahead of the game, maybe they could be Ohio State. You know what I'm saying?
Yep. Mac Brown is the only coach in the history of the University of Texas who has been able to recruit without race being an issue.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when you wonder, why is it that Mac won at Texas in a way that nobody else after Royal could, although it's more specific than after Royal, it's after integration.
Mm-hmm.
It's because he was the only coach that shook that off. Okay. Charlie Strong had to deal with race in a different way.
Yeah.
But race was at the forefront of his time there. And then Herman is his own interesting, fascinating case. But that was the thing. Mac was the only guy that didn't have to deal with that. Because you're right. They brought in a black quarterback in 1996. And they're like, yo, finally, maybe people will, you know, leave us alone.
Right. They'll look at us differently. And that's just kind of crazy to explain, too, because the Texas A&M didn't have to deal with that.
But here's why they didn't have to deal with that. They hired Jackie Sherrill.
Right.
Right? Like, Texas A&M might have had this larger problem. Jackie Sherrill had no such issues.
Oh, yeah. And remember, Kyler Murray's daddy was a black quarterback there in the 80s. That wasn't something that was very common back then.
Right, playing for Jackie Sherrill. Mm-hmm. And Jackie Sherrill is adamant that the only reason that Kevin Murray did not play in the NFL is because he was black.
Yep, absolutely.
Once I learned that, I was like, oh, Kyler ain't playing baseball. totally misunderstood.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Even though his uncle, you know, was insistent, oh, he's going to play baseball. He's going to play. I was like, nah, he's not going to play baseball. I'm sorry.
Nah. But A&M, they had like their run with Sherrill of like three straight SWC championships. Mm-hmm. And then they had another one in the 90s that was at a similar place because that became where the good black players in Texas were going, which had never really happened before. I mean, they couldn't even get Eric Dickerson, and he's from Sealy, and you and I both know that real estate.
Right,
that
up the
is
street.
Aggie country.
Absolutely. Right up the street, too. Yeah, man. They should have gotten that dude. Were they the ones that supposedly got him to Trans Am or something like
yes,
that?
Yeah, yes. Okay. Trans A&M.
Yeah. Yeah. So it still, you know, it still didn't work out for him. But yeah, man, having Kevin Murray, having Jackie Sherrill, having that legacy of success, I just thought, as we talked about earlier, I thought A&M was something totally different than what it actually is. You know?
They be fooling us. Yeah. USC will do that to you.
Oh,
the University of South Central?
Oh,
yeah. Kind of, but not really.
Rodney Pete, you know what I'm saying? And all the people to root for him and all that stuff?
Yo, here's what's wild about Rodney Pete. Bet you haven't thought about this till right now. Name one black quarterback at USC after Rodney Pete.
Oh, my God.
You can't.
Ooh.
30 years.
Man.
30 years.
Ooh.
30 years, you are the official school of black Los Angeles.
Man, that's a great point. I can't even think of a recruit that they would have had that left.
Not a one. I can't think of a recruit. Not a one.
You know, their deal is they get the top guys out of Orange County.
Yep. They get all those like quarterback lessons since I was whatever age. Mm-hmm. But they've stuck to this. We're going to have a pro style offense for all these years. And I've wondered if they were basically saying we're going to keep getting white quarterbacks.
Yeah.
Pro style was always a wink, wink, nudge, nudge, white.
I sent that link to you the other night where they had that kid who is a USC recruit who is who's from
Valdosta.
He wanted, who wants to play high school football so bad he's moving to Valdosta, Georgia for the fall. And I'm just like, what? Another one of those like prototypical 6'3", 6'4" quarterback.
Yeah.
That's what USC does, you know?
Yeah, his last name is Garcia, by the way. He gonna get called Mexican more than he ever has in his life when he get down. I don't even know. Like, I'm assuming that there's probably somebody Mexican, like, to get the Garcia name.
Yeah.
I'm not saying he's passing.
Right.
But they're white Mexicans, too.
Oh, absolutely.
Nah, partner. When you get to Valdosta, I don't care how white you are. You are gonna be a Mexican.
Oh, yeah.
Not even a Mexican. You're not even gonna get three syllables, dog. You're gonna be a Mexican.
Yeah, the Garcia's gonna come up. You know what I'm saying? Like, you're gonna be a little bit out of your element. I can't believe you love football enough to want to play it in Valdosta for a fall, but hey, man, I guess that must be a business.
Did he research this place before he made this decision?
He had to have. He had to have. The thing that
I feel like he had to have not.
Oh, really? Well, I mean, the guy at Valdosta now was the head coach that used to be at Hoover when Hoover, Alabama, was a big thing. So, you know, he was known for those offenses and having powerhouses, and I don't know how he ended up at Valdosta. I know he left Hoover under some weird circumstances, so... You know, he went where he had to go, and I guess, you know, they're going to figure it out down there.
I'm just telling you right now, ESPN moved a home office to Valdosta, and I don't work here no more.
You talking about it like it's Bristol, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I'm not saying anything bad about Bristol. I am simply saying I ain't going to Valdosta. That is it. That's my man, Joel Anderson. Check him out at Slate. Oh, what's the podcast? I always forget the title.
Hang Up and Listen.
Hang Up and Listen. You got to advertise these things more. I'm your homie and you ain't even never
my
told
bad,
me
man. You know, I'm sorry, bro. I'm going to send you a link every night.
I want to support. You know what I'm saying?
You. I
got to do that. I got to do that. But ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. My man, Gabe Bassane, handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Thank you also, Tarika Foster. See, I'm getting better, getting them habits right. Remember, subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. We'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.